Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you listen to this program regularly, you know what it's all about. We want to honor our World War II veterans, our greatest generation. We want to remember their service and their sacrifice, preserve those stories for posterity, and maybe along the way learn a thing or two. Maybe we'll be inspired by how much they love our country. I'm excited about today's program for a lot of reasons. I always enjoy just sitting and listening to the veteran stories. But this is the 150th episode of this show here on KMJ. And throughout all those episodes, I've never interviewed a veteran who was in the same division as my grandfather, who was a battalion surgeon attached to the 6th Armored Division in World War II. Today's guest, Gus Caceres, is also a veteran of the Super 6th. He served in the 50th Armored Infantry Battalion as a rifleman in Company C. But long before that, Gus, you were just a kid growing up in Flint, Michigan. And I bet you've been watching the news the last couple of weeks and seeing how cold it is in Flint, Michigan, and being thankful that you live in California.
Absolutely.
Flint, Michigan is where you were, I presume, on December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day? How did you find out that America was at war?
Well, we were driving out to Fenton with the family, mm-hmm. my parents and the rest of my other siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard on the radio before we got to Fenton that the Pearl Harbor had been struck by the Japs, 2:30 in the afternoon. That's how we found out.
Did it mean anything to you at the time?
Yes, it did.
Tell me, what did it produce a visceral reaction in you? What did it
feel
like?
Well, I just wanted to get into it. In fact, the very next day, three of my buddies, we went down to Windsor, Canada, which was 60 miles away, and tried to join the Royal Canadian Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
But we were Americans. Had we gone down December 6th, they would have been glad to take us. But my other buddy, who was Canadian-born, he went in, and he was a mosquito bomber pilot during the war, which was the fastest airplane at that time. It was a plane that was made out of wood.
Yeah, the British had plenty of them, and they did plenty of good work over there.
They called it the mosquito bomber.
Exactly. So you couldn't get into the Canadian Royal Air Force, and you had to settle for the United States Army. How long did it take you before you enlisted in the Army?
Well, I didn't enlist. I got drafted.
So
I was 4F for a couple of years. And finally, they lowered the requirements. I had a birthmark. And for that reason, they would not take me. But finally, they did take me. I tried to enlist in ordnance. I tried to enlist in, but they turned me down.
That had to be frustrating that you wanted to serve.
And then I finally got a job in a tank plant.
Uh-huh.
And where they made
the Sherman tanks?
The Sherman tank. And I was working at receiving the metal from the steel mills.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I stopped production of the plant because they had warp plates. And I stopped production. So I had the superintendent hounded me. And I said, I'm sorry, we cannot accept them. And then later on, they put another plate on the side of the upper hull plate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and to illustrate for our listeners who maybe aren't reading between the lines, the importance of that, you felt you had to stop production because these plates were warped because the tanks would not have been as protective or as effective for American troops.
That is correct.
So you had to do something for the war effort, and that's what
right.
you found to do.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, Uncle Sam said, you know what, we're running out of bodies over there. We need some more.
Absolutely.
Was that exciting for you when they said, we'll take you now?
Oh, absolutely. I was glad.
Did you care where they sent you or what they had you do?
Well, I tried to even join military intelligence because I speak Greek fluently.
Mm-hmm.
But they turned me down there, too. But one of my friends I went to school with, he jumped into northern Greece and joined up with the guerrillas.
Wow.
He just passed away here a few weeks ago.
There are so many stories of what people did in this incredible time in our history. And I'm sure you could tell us a lot more stories about other people, but I want to get more about your story. So you finally are in the Army. You tried to go with the Canadians and their Air Force.
Correct.
You're in the regular Army
right.
with the American forces. How long did it take you before they hurried up and got you sent overseas?
Well, it didn't take long.
Mm-hmm.
After basic training, they sent me overseas.
So
after
when did
13 weeks.
So when did they get you over there? Because I know the 6th Armored was over there as early as July of 1944.
Yeah, I was a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And I got overseas and just in time for the Belgian bulge. I mean, it was practically almost over. Because I didn't get there till January 15th.
January 15th of 1945.
45.
There were still 10 days left in the Battle of the Bulge at that point.
And that's right.
I'm sure it was still completely frozen over. And
oh, it was the coldest winter in 50 years.
A lot colder than Flint, Michigan even,
yeah,
huh?
Yes.
I want to ask you, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here and take you right to Bastogne, but on the journey over, here you had wanted to get in the day after Pearl Harbor. You'd done whatever you could for your country in the tank plant and trying to get into the service, and now you're finally heading overseas. What was that journey across the Atlantic like for you? Were you fraught with anticipation?
Well, we were 15,000 on the Queen Mary.
Uh-huh. That's a pretty good group.
Yeah, and we landed in Scotland.
Were you anxious? Were you excited? How would you describe your frame of mind?
We just wanted to get in there and finish the war.
And you knew what you'd be doing. You knew you'd be in a rifle company.
Right.
Did that make you think, you know what, I might not be coming home?
Never give it a thought.
No?
No.
Didn't occur to you that while you're shooting at them, they're going to be shooting at you
no.
too? Well, you mentioned that your first taste of combat was at the infamous Battle of the Bulge. And you also mentioned that you're a replacement. And whenever I talk to someone who is a replacement, I have to ask them, if that label alone made you think twice, if you say you're a replacement troop, that means there's somebody that you're replacing that, you know, wasn't able to keep doing what he was doing. That in itself could be a little intimidating.
That's true.
How did you deal with that? What kept you focused and motivated?
Well, we knew we had a job to do. That was our priority. We had to get in there and finish the war.
So being in a rifle company, what duties did you have? How did you understand what you were expected to do?
Well, we're on a half track.
Mm-hmm.
We had a machine gunner, you know. And we all had rifles. Some of us had lighter weapons, you know.
I saw a picture of you there with a P-38 revolver.
Yeah, a German. And that's dangerous. If you would have got caught as a prisoner of war and you had a German, I don't think they would treat you very good.
Yeah, that is not American issue. That is confiscated from the enemy. And we might get to a story about that a little bit later. So when you got there, and here you are, a replacement troop for the bloodiest battle of the war in the European theater, did on the way in to Bastogne, did you get a glimpse of the carnage, of the devastation, of what the guys before you had gone through?
I really can't remember. I mean, they just rushed us up there and...
You didn't have much time to think about how bad it might be.
No.
So what was it like once you got there? What was the first thing that kind of confronted you?
Well, I know it was the coldest winter in 50 years.
Right.
And it was very cold.
But that half track is plenty heated, right? Sure, you're out to the open air, but I'm sure you had heated seat cushions.
Oh, yeah.
How did you stay warm?
I tell you, we didn't have time to think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you're at nighttime and you have to find somewhere to sleep?
We slept even with the hogs and the cows, mm-hmm. wherever we could sleep, you know.
Anything that might give you a little bit of warmth.
And then we would dig a big hole and cut down some trees. And then by the time we got it finished, we'd have to move on.
Exactly.
Yeah. We were on the go all the time.
Well, and I've talked to so many veterans from the Battle of the Bulge, including my grandfather, and when they talk about digging a hole in the ground, just to dig a foxhole, you have to break through a couple feet of frozen ground, don't you?
Well, it was pretty soft underneath.
Yeah.
It was pretty soft, really. It hadn't really frozen that much.
In those first few days there at the Battle of the Bulge, did you ever have a moment where you said, what am I doing here? How did I end up in this position?
And, you know, I have to tell you a funny story.
Let's hear it.
When I landed in France, I was talking to a cook,
mm-hmm.
and he asked me what I did back in Michigan. I said, well, my father had a restaurant.
All right.
I was a cook. He said, hey, I can get you off this roster and have you stay here in La Harve.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to where the battle is going on because that's what I'm trained for.
Right.
But a few days later, I was kicking myself in the butt. I said, what am I doing here?
Making shish kebab in La Harve would have been a lot more fun, huh?
Yeah, right.
Well, it's funny how somebody always has different plans for us than the ones that we might come up with in our own mind. So you could have stayed there out of the action, but you said, this is what I've been waiting for 4 years, almost 3.5 years to get over there. And here you arrive at the Battle of the Bulge, freezing conditions. Did you actually get to engage the enemy fairly quickly there?
Yes. Well, even coming into Bastogne, we got fired on.
All right.
Yeah.
Was that a little bit of a wake-you-up moment for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I said, I'm here for the big show.
I guess so. And at that point, when you are finally there, something you've been anticipating for so long, did you feel like what you had gone through in 13 weeks of training and everything leading up to this had prepared you for it?
Yes. It was very good.
You were ready.
Right. I didn't like where I was trained at down in Camp Hood, Texas. It was so hot down there.
Well, what would you prefer, the heat of Texas or the frozen ground of the Ardennes Forest?
Well, there's no choice. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk much more about the Battle of the Bulge with Gus Caceres, 88 years old, a veteran of the 6th Armored Division, more specifically the 50th Armored Infantry Battalion. We'll talk to Gus about where he was wounded, how it happened, what he remembers about the rest of World War II. Gus Caceres, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A couple of notes for you before we continue. I was at the double play dinner for Fresno State Baseball last night at Pardini's, and there's some great news. If you're a veteran or active duty military and you like baseball, every Sunday home game this year at Fresno State's Biden Field, every Sunday home game, veterans and active duty military get in free. I think that's terrific. I salute Fresno State for doing it. The Dugout Club had a big role in that, and I hope that you'll take advantage of that every Sunday afternoon when the Bulldogs are home for baseball. So I was at Pardini's last night, and I hope that you'll think about being there a week from tomorrow. I know we have listeners up and down the state, but if you're in the Fresno area at Pardini's a week from tomorrow, it's the Day of Remembrance. Every year in February, we talk about this. Executive Order 9066, which President Roosevelt passed, of course, in February of 1942, that led to the forced internment of more than 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II, many of whom went on to serve our country during World War II. We've talked about that before in the program. The annual Day of Remembrance banquet is coming up Sunday, February 20th. It starts at noon. If you're interested in going, there'll be some awards that are handed out. You'll get a piece of history. You'll learn about efforts to put together the Fresno Assembly Center Memorial, which will be dedicated at the Big Fresno Fair in October. It'll be beautiful, just like the one in Pinedale and the one in Merced. So if you'd like to go to that banquet a week from tomorrow, call this number, 960-0852, 960-0852. The Japanese American Citizens League does a terrific job preserving history. Let's get on to the history we're discussing on this program now with Gus Caceres. Our guest today is 88 years old, now lives in Fresno, California. He's originally from Flint, Michigan, but in January of 1945, he was stuck in Bastogne, the infamous city that if you've ever read anything about the Battle of the Bulge, you've probably heard of. The Battle of the Bulge claimed more than 19,000 American lives, not to mention those killed from British forces and, of course, on the enemy side from the Germans. And we've been talking to Gus Caceres about his experiences there. He was part of a replacement group that came in with the 50th Armored Infantry Battalion, the Super 6th, the 6th Armored Division. And I'm curious, Gus, when you got there and you become part of this 6th Armored Division, the Super 6th under Patton's 3rd Army, did you hear stories from the guys who had been around for a while about what they'd been through to get to Bastogne?
Not really. I don't recall that.
No time for that,
no,
huh?
No.
Because they had been through quite a bit.
Right.
I guess you don't earn that nickname, the Super 6th, for nothing, right?
That's right.
When you're in an armored division, a lot of people assume, hey, maybe he's inside a tank, because they think of the tank battalions immediately.
Right.
But as a rifleman riding on top of a half track, you didn't have a whole lot of protection, did you?
None.
None whatsoever. And give us an idea of what you were up against in terms of what the enemy was lobbing your way.
Well, when I got wounded, we were going forward, going north, then we headed east, and then we got caught in a crossfire. We got hit by 20-millimeter cannon fire. That's how I got wounded.
And that wasn't till March of 1945.
30th of March was on a Good Friday.
So that's a good 2 months after the Battle of the Bulge. I want to ask you a little more about the Bulge while we're on it, because so many people have so many questions about that. And they've heard the term and don't know exactly what it was like. You were there for the last 10 days of the battle. I bet you can remember the first time that you heard a German 88.
Oh, absolutely. I was on a tank.
What did that sound like?
It went whistling by me. If it had hit the tank, I wouldn't be here.
Well, I'm glad they missed.
I'm glad, too.
Had you ever encountered anything like that before in your life?
No.
How do you react to something like that when you see it? I mean, does that get your attention and make you think about what might be happening down the road?
Never give it a thought.
Never give it a thought. Fair enough. But I'm sure that you saw firsthand the damage that those 88s could do.
Oh, absolutely. We had a lot of respect for them.
How did you handle it? Because I'm sure being there at the Bulge for the last 10 days, I'm sure you saw things that you would like to have not seen. You probably saw buddies of yours get hit.
We saw a lot of bodies frozen, like when they went through plowing the road. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you see a body and it'd be a brand new uniform. So, you know, he was probably a replacement, just like myself.
Absolutely.
And there they were, frozen stiff.
And does that kind of tell you I might be next?
Never give it a thought.
You're consistent with that. And that's probably why you're still going and you look so young at 88. I understand a lot of people tell you don't look your age.
Absolutely.
Well, I agree with them. And I'll put a picture up on our website, kmjnow.com, to prove it. We'll also post some pictures of Gus back in his World War II days in the 6th Armored Division. Did you have an idea when the Battle of the Bulge was finally wrapping up? Did you have an idea that it actually was ending? Because I imagine as it's going on, you kind of lose track of what day it is and what's happening.
Well, we knew once the Ardennes campaign was over, Germany was finished. We knew it was only going to be a matter of time, mm-hmm. and the war would be over.
At that point, and maybe you have a different perspective, having come in the middle of that battle than guys who were there at the start of it, did you have any idea of how significant that was in the greater scheme of World War II? I mean, you just said you felt like the Germans were finished. Did you know what you guys were doing was as important as history has proven it to be?
Well, you know, we had the 4th Armored and 6th Armored. We always worked together.
Right.
Like this, pincers, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And we had the, we were in the 20th and 12th Corps. And like the 5th Division, the 90th Division, they were always behind us, you know. But we were expendable, you know. If the tanks couldn't get through, they'd send us riflemen up because we were expendable. The government only had to pay $10,000 for us, where a tank costs $80,000.
That doesn't sound very reassuring.
I know.
Well, what was that like if you are going ahead not knowing what you're going to encounter? How do you proceed in those situations? What kinds of things are you looking for?
You're trying to avoid getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I think the thing that saved us more than anything else was the fact that a lot of the munitions the Germans were using were made by foreign labor, and they were duds, especially the mortars. They would come in, and they'd be duds, or we wouldn't be here.
And the implication there, and I've read many stories about this, when you say foreign labor, these in a lot of instances were forced captives who were forced to work in these munitions plants, and they were purposely sabotaging the ammunition.
That's correct. Thank God for that.
Yeah, maybe you wouldn't be here if that weren't the case. But give us a sense, if you can, of how intense those situations were. I mean, was this something that on a given day, maybe you're dealing with that for 20 minutes or half an hour, or are you dealing with that for hours on end in terms of the incoming fire?
All you did is you wanted to stay alive.
Yeah.
That was the key thing.
Did it seem like a never-ending situation for you, like you were constantly on guard and under attack?
Absolutely.
And how often did you find yourself firing your own weapon?
had one particular situation where we were on a roadblock. There was two of us, one on one side of the road, and all of a sudden we heard a motorcycle guy coming down. And we fired, and we missed him. And he came within probably, oh, I would say 40 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
And I hollered at him. I said, come and see here. And anyway, he tried to shoot me, and I ended up shooting and killing him. He's the only person that I know that I killed.
How close did his shot come to you?
I don't know. They missed me. That was the main thing.
You just, and I've been through this so many times with so many veterans, where they've lived something, so they describe something as if it's no big deal. But I'm picturing myself as you, and I mean, here you are, you're in your early 20s, you've got your whole life in front of you, and you've got a guy 40 yards away shooting a gun right at you, and if you don't shoot him, he's going to kill you.
Absolutely.
Did you get nervous in that situation?
No, I didn't get nervous. I knew that it had to be done. I don't feel bad that I killed him.
No.
Because I knew if I didn't kill him, he would have killed me.
Mm-hmm.
Or wounded me.
Wow, I can't imagine being in your shoes in a situation like that, but that's what happens in war. As you moved on from there, you said that when the Battle of the Bulge was over and you had pushed back that German offensive, that you believed things were coming to an end. Did that give you any more of a sense of security, though, as you continued to move?
No.
You knew things were still going to be pretty hot.
That's correct.
So from there, tell us about where you guys went as a battalion.
Well, after we left the Bulge, we went through Luxembourg, and we met the general. We took all our identification off because we moved from the 3rd Army, went down where the 7th Army was, right near the Swiss border.
Mm-hmm.
We had taken all our markings of the 6th Army, so the Germans thought the 6th Army was destroyed. That's the impression we wanted to give them.
Uh-huh.
But we were very much alive.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we got down there and on the Siegfried Line, and we punched a hole and went through all the way to Worms in 48 hours. And we were attached then to a cavalry outfit, and our objective was to get across the bridge and hold. But unfortunately, the Germans had already blown the bridge.
And I'm sure that was not the first time that what you expected is not what you found.
That's correct.
What was the camaraderie among troops like? You've shown me some pictures here of your squad, and I think you said it was a good squad. You have some fond memories about
these
men.
Yes, I do.
What was that like? How did you guys kind of support each other and lean on each other to get through those times?
Well, I'll tell you, they were like brothers. I mean, this young man that sent me all these pictures, Ernest Hoke from Lebanon, Missouri, was only 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like a big brother, you know.
You were the old man in the group.
I was the old man.
And you were all of, 23 years old?
22.
You get to the river. The bridge is blown up.
Correct.
What do you do from there?
We stayed right there
for
2 days, and then we crossed the Rhine River at Oppenheim on the 25th of March. They built a bridge, you know what I mean?
The engineers put a bridge together.
Yeah, and they had smoke screens up and down for about 2 miles each way, so the Germans couldn't hit it.
So the Germans wouldn't see
then
it going up and
then we went across the Rhine River, and we went into Frankfurt, Germany. And we had a lot of artillery blowing up before we got there, so it was very easy for us when we got in there. We didn't have much resistance.
In terms of crossing the Rhine, and obviously you guys weren't the first American troops to cross the Rhine, but to get there, to go across it, did that have some significance to you guys when you did it?
We were glad we were going across, and we were glad we got across.
Did that seem like a milestone moment for you with everything you'd been through?
Not really. It's just everyday work.
Mm-hmm. And so that was the 25th of March. And if you were listening closely at home, you heard Gus say earlier that he was injured on the 30th of March. So after this short break, when we come back, we'll hear Gus tell us the story of how he was wounded, how he recovered, and how he's here sitting with us today on Hometown Heroes. Gus Caceres, 88 years old of Fresno, California, our guest today. We'll be back with more of the program next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Let's continue now with 88-year-old Gus Caceres. If you're Greek, you recognize that as a Greek name. And I will not say it's all Greek to me today, because I think Gus has made a whole lot of sense. And I want to thank a couple of his friends from the Greek Orthodox Church in Fresno, George Giannopoulos and Kopi Sotiropoulos. You may know Kopi a little bit. He's on TV quite a bit. He's everywhere. And I want to thank both of those guys for letting me know about Gus. You've got some good friends, Gus, and I know that was the case in World War II as well. Give me the story. I'll try to stay out of your way here and let you tell the story of March 30th, 1945. Where were you and what happened?
We were heading towards Kassel.
Kassel, Germany. Uh-huh.
As I said, we were going north, and then we turned right, and we got caught in a crossfire where there were some fanatical SS troops there. And they fired, and they hit me. And we were going to cross this bridge, but we stopped short of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got off the half track, and the medic gave me some morphine. And my company commander come up to me. He says, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm doing fine." I says, "I'll be back in a couple of days."
Where were you hit?
In the buttocks.
With what?
Was 20 millimeter cannon fire.
20 millimeter.
Yeah. They're little, small, little pieces of metal.
Mm-hmm.
About a quarter of an inch. In fact, I was going to bring one down here to show you, but I didn't find it.
So you saved some of the shrapnel?
Yes, I did.
When they took it out?
No, I had surgery afterwards.
Uh-huh.
They kept working out.
Well, at the time, I'm sure looking back, you're probably thankful that that's where you got hit.
Yeah, right.
You could have been hit in a lot worse places.
That's right.
At the time, I bet it hurt quite a bit.
Well, I didn't have any feeling, really.
Yeah?
I was like in shock. All I knew, I'd been hit.
Mm-hmm.
And after they gave me the morphine, I was on cloud nine.
Yeah, that's probably the best feeling you'd had in the war.
But what they had to, they took us back on a Jeep.
Uh-huh.
And they fired on the first Jeep, taking wounded out. And we took 50 German prisoners of war for protection until we got out of range.
Mm.
And they sent me back to an evacuation hospital where they performed the surgery. And then a couple of days later, they flew me to, from Frankfurt, Germany, they flew me to Paris. And I arrived in Paris on the first day of April, which was Easter Sunday.
Mm.
And I stayed there till April 12th when President Roosevelt died.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me from Paris to England to recuperate. And I was there for a month. And they sent me home to the States. And I was in the first ship. There was five ships that left on Mother's Day on the 13th of May back to the States. Two of them went into Boston. And three of us went into New York. And we got there, passed the Statue of Liberty on the 23rd of May, about 10:30, and I was so happy. And when I got off the ship the next morning on the 24th, I got off and I kissed the ground. I said, "I hope I never leave these shores again." And luckily, they sent me to a hospital in Chicago, which was only about a four-hour drive from Flint, Michigan. And luckily, I got a 30-day leave from the hospital, and I went home, and I attended a wedding on June 24th, and that's when I met my wife.
Well, that's my anniversary with my wife, June 24th. I think that's a pretty good day.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you were at a wedding that day. So you met your wife at this wedding on June 24th of 45.
Right, and she lived in a town about 30 miles from Chicago, Gary, Indiana.
Uh-huh.
So we used to see each other quite a bit, and my cousins in Chicago would come and visit me. In fact, they were there at the hospital when the war ended because they wouldn't let us out.
Mm-hmm. So you just gave us that story of being wounded, being evacuated, and all of that. And it sounds like even your evacuation was a little hairy when they're firing on the Jeep that you're riding in.
That's right.
Have you ever looked back in that and said, well, the cliche is a $1 million wound, but have you ever looked back and said,
the zone of interior is what they said. When that old Texas colonel said, "You're going home."
Have you ever looked back on that and thought, you know, maybe that was a good thing for me to get hit there at that time and get out of there when I did?
I tell you, I never really give it a thought.
Yeah.
I didn't know what my destiny was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I count my blessings that I did make it back home.
So you did make it back home, and you kind of briefly described going past the Statue of Liberty. What was that like on the ship? Was that something where everybody stopped what they were doing and looked up?
Oh, I don't know what the rest of them were doing, but I know one thing. I was very emotional.
Sure.
But we had to wait till the tugboats took us into, you know, into New York.
So you got a plenty long good look at Lady Liberty there.
Yeah.
You said it was emotional. Can you kind of try to tap into some of those emotions? Why that was emotional for you? For people who haven't lived what you lived, why was that so special to you to come by that statue at that point in time?
Because that shows you what all America's all about. I mean, that's our foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was glad to be back home.
Well, I don't blame you. I would be too. You mentioned meeting your wife. And I'm sure you can trace the steps and say, if this didn't happen and that didn't happen and I wasn't here because of that, that I wouldn't have met my wife.
That's correct.
But you did. Did it? What was it like to be a wounded veteran back home in America? Because we certainly have that now with the wars that are going on. And people see the dynamic that we have with our current servicemen coming home. Give us a taste, if you can, of what it was like for you in 1945 to be back from the war. What was America like? How were you welcomed and how were you treated?
We were treated very good, especially in New York when we arrived. We were the first troops to arrive after the war finished, and they gave us a roaring welcome. We couldn't buy a drink. Everybody was buying us drinks. And I had a picture of this nightclub that we were in with four or five other of my party, mm-hmm. but I couldn't find it.
Mm. I'm sure you can picture it in your mind.
Yeah, I can close my eyes right now and see this table. Yeah.
You know, and you had gone over there, and you told us that the day after Pearl Harbor, you wanted to get into it, and you had to wait a while, but you finally got into it. You went over there. You did what you did. You came home. When you were back, did you have a different perspective on life because of what you had been through? Did you have kind of a greater determination or feel like you had a fresh start at life after all of that?
I really didn't ever give it a thought. It never crossed my mind.
When you think about, and you were at the Battle of the Bulge, you know how many Americans died there. You know that, you know, more than 400,000 Americans died in all the theaters of World War II. When you think about that, what does that mean to you? The number of lives that were lost doing the kinds of things that you were doing?
Well, we all paid, you know. That was our job. It was either that or we'd be speaking Japanese or German in this country. Mm-hmm. We had to win. Branches of the service. I don't care if you were in the Navy, the Air Corps, you know. We had a job to do.
If it had been speaking Greek, you would have been okay with it. Well, and something else strikes me here, too. You described earlier on in the program working in the tank factory.
Yeah.
And
Grand Blanc, Michigan.
There you go. And you talk about everyone having a job to do. I bet that the people you worked with at the tank plant felt that what they were doing was pretty important too.
Absolutely.
And people who didn't live during that time, obviously I was not alive in World War II. I've heard a lot of stories, but I wasn't alive. What can you tell us as people who weren't born yet at this time in our history about what America was like then, when you talk about the tank plant or serving overseas, in terms of the united nature and the focus of what America was? Do you see a difference between the world we have today and what things were like back then?
Absolutely.
What was so different, and what made that time period so special in
your
eyes?
When I grew up during the Depression, you didn't hear of any crime. You never locked your doors. You could leave your keys in your car.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great America. I mean, even with the Depression, people didn't rob any. You never heard of murders or robberies.
Mm-hmm.
And today, America's changed, which I don't like. I feel sorry for the young generation coming up now, the things they have to face.
Do you think that there's anything from the time that you lived in at that age in the 1940s, is there anything that happened or anything that was characteristic of that time that you think we could employ today, that you think we could learn from today and maybe get back a little closer to that?
Well, I think a lot of things that happen in this country are controlled in Congress, in the Senate, you know.
Sure.
The politicians have always made so many mistakes in the past, from World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, and they're making mistakes overseas right now. And a lot of these wars were unnecessary.
You know, another thing that hits me, and we'll catch another commercial here in a minute, but I'm thinking about what the group of soldiers that you were with did after you were injured. Had you not been injured and you would have finished out, you know, through VE Day in Europe, that maybe you would have been a part of liberating some of the camps that were liberated, or at least witnessing some of that. Had you any idea at the time what had been going on in Europe, what Hitler's regime had been doing to those people?
No, I had no knowledge. But I was very fortunate in Frankfurt. I liberated some Greek people that had been working in the factories.
Mm-hmm.
And you think God Almighty came down. When I spoke to them in Greek, they were just... I'm sure today they're still talking about it, because I gave them cigarettes and shaving equipment, and they wanted to come along and fight with us. I said, no, the American government will send you back. But they wanted to come along and fight.
Well, I want to get more of this story now. You piqued my interest. So this is when you guys are moving through Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Is there any fighting going on? Or
the fighting had just actually finished.
Mm-hmm. But these Greek people working in a factory had been forced to work there?
Yes. Yeah. They were forced there.
So they are basically, for lack of a better word, slaves to a hostile regime.
That's correct.
And you show up with a few of your buddies?
Yeah. Well, my buddy was a sergeant, was Polish from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And he liberated some Polish. And they told him there were Greeks also there. And when I spoke to him in Greek... And I even had a letter from a friend of mine from Chicago that wrote, he didn't speak English too much. He wrote to me in Greek,
mm-hmm.
and I showed him the letter, and they couldn't believe it. He says, well, how did you learn to speak Greek? I said, well, my parents are from Greece,
mm-hmm.
and I had to go to Greek school. I says, I hated it, but anyway, they forced me to go. So I was very glad they did.
And I bet as you reflect on that moment now, you're probably pretty thankful your folks made you go to Greek school.
Oh, yes.
Do you? I know this may be testing your memory because we're talking about 66 years ago here almost. Do you remember what you said to those Greek factory workers to try to break the news to them that they didn't have to stay there anymore, that they were actually free?
Yes. Well, I spoke to them in Greek and told them that they didn't have to come along. They wanted to come along.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, the Greek government will come along, the American government will come along and send you back to Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were elated.
Were they doing jumping jacks? Were they hugging you?
They were. And then they cooked in a big frying pan about like this,
uh-huh.
and we ate out of the frying pan, the potatoes, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. It was quite an experience.
Oh, I believe it. Well, I know there are more experiences that we can pull out of Gus Caceres today. We'll have a few more minutes with the program when we come back. Gus is 88 years old. He lives in Fresno, and I'm sure you can tell by listening to him that his memory is still pretty sharp. If you want to see pictures of Gus or any of the veterans that you hear featured on this program, go to kmjnow.com, or you can also take a look at all those photo albums on Facebook. Just type in Hometown Heroes on Facebook. We'll be right back. More from Gus Caceres next. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We've got another 10 minutes or so to sit and listen to the stories that Gus Caceres has for you. And one thing I don't mention very often on this program, but those of you who know me well know that the reason I got into interviewing World War II veterans was my own grandfather served in the war. Like so many veterans, he didn't talk much about it when he came home. It was kind of a forgotten part of family history, and I eventually realized that that was the case for most of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II. I eventually got him to talk about it, and I've been talking to at least a veteran every week since then. It's been a few years now, but in all that time, I've never encountered another veteran who served in that same division, the 6th Armored Division, as my grandfather did. So on a personal note, it's been an extra special pleasure today to listen to Gus, who was with the 6th Armored Division. And we were just talking off air about a presidential unit citation that was supposed to have been awarded, and you've never heard anything more of it.
Never received it, no.
I'm going to have to investigate that. We'll see what we can find out about that. You did receive the Purple Heart for your wound in the rear end.
Right.
I'm curious, any of your buddies ever give you a hard time about where you were wounded?
Oh, yes.
What kinds of stuff would they say, if it's clean?
Well, I'd rather not talk about that.
All right, fair enough. Well, I'm sure that I can tell it still gave you a chuckle all these years later. I know that you're very active in the Greek Orthodox Church here in Fresno, and so that makes me wonder if you've ever looked back at your time in World War II, looked at everything that could have happened to you, everything that you saw around you, the freezing conditions of the Battle of the Bulge, the carnage, your own injuries, if you ever looked back at that and said, you know what, I think God was looking out for me.
Well, absolutely.
Is that something that was a part of your life at that point? Were you you said your parents made you go to Greek school.
Yeah.
Was faith a big part of your life at that point?
Well, when I was in Michigan, I served on the church board for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was a church treasurer. When they built a new church in Flint, Michigan in 1962, I was the treasurer. I was responsible. In fact, I was on the job every morning till 5 o'clock at night, supervising, watching how the money was being spent, because it was on a cost-plus basis.
Gotcha.
So anyway, I have donated a lot of time to the church,
mm-hmm.
which I'm very proud to say.
I'm just curious if your experience in the church or in a relationship with God or whatever, if that was something that helped you in your time overseas. Is that something where you felt that someone was with you, that you were a praying man, or you felt that had a role in what you were doing?
I even went to a Catholic church and took communion,
Mm-hmm.
I've been very religious all my life.
And the other thing that comes to mind on that, in this area of your life, I've heard some people say that being in a war situation, you of course hear there's no atheists in foxholes, everyone will tell you that. I've also had some people, because of the things that they saw, it maybe made them question their faith. What about you? Do you think your experience in the Army either made you more committed to your faith or less committed?
Oh, I wouldn't say I gauged that, because
no real impact.
No real impact. No, not really.
Fair enough. Let's talk about something else here. You mentioned, if people go back to the early stages of our interview, that the day after Pearl Harbor, you went north of the border to Windsor, Ontario.
Oh, south.
South, because of where you were in Flint. That's right. Yeah. I got to get my geography straight.
Yeah, across the Detroit River.
Yep. And if
in
you
Windsor,
know Michigan,
Canada.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I've been there. So you went into Canada, our neighbors to the north, even though you had to go south, because you wanted to sign up and you wanted to fly. You wanted to be with their Air Force.
Royal Canadian Air Force.
Didn't work for you at that point. You ended up in the U.S. Army. But you did eventually become a pilot.
Yes.
Was that something that was exciting for you to all these years later finally get to do that?
Well, I became a pilot and I became a skier,
mm-hmm.
after 40 years old.
Hey, that's encouraging to me, because I'm not a pilot or a skier, and I'm not 40, so there's still hope for me. So you were flying from the 1960s all the way till 1980.
Right.
And as you're a survivor of the Battle of the Bulge, you're a survivor of being wounded in action, you've got the Purple Heart to prove it. You also have a distinction not too many of us can claim. You're the survivor of an airplane crash.
That's correct.
Tell us what happened there.
Well, I happened to be visiting my brother, Nick Caceres, who's a land developer. He had a project up in Medford, Oregon. And I was getting ready to leave on Saturday. But Friday, the 12th of December, we decided to go up. We were delayed because of fog here in Fresno.
Surprise, surprise.
Till about 11:30. So when we got up to Medford, we couldn't land. So we landed on the California-Oregon border, and we rented a car and came in for the meeting. Meanwhile, the pilot brought the plane up from on the border of Oregon and California to Ashland, which was 12 miles south of Medford. We went in for the meeting, came back. And I asked the pilot, I says, what's the weather? He says, well, 300 feet up, it's good. I said, I'm not interested 300 feet up. I'm interested on the ground. He says, well, it's kind of bad. I said, well, I think maybe we should wait and go tomorrow. And he says, well, if that's the case, I'm going to go across and have a drink. I said, listen, Buster, you're not taking me anywhere if you have one drink.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we dropped it at that point. And a little later, about half an hour later, he says, well, get in the plane. And I didn't get in. I flew right seat going up. And my brother's partner sat in the right seat, and I sat across from my brother. It was a seven-passenger Aero Commander. It was a beautiful plane.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my brother was going to buy it the very next week. Mm. But unfortunately, on takeoff, he lost the right engine. Mm. And down we came, and we came down and hit a pole and missed a house by about 25 yards, a greenhouse by about 50 yards. The plane hit the pole. The plane flopped over on its back. And I couldn't believe I was alive. I got thrown out of the airplane, and I couldn't believe I was alive.
Holy moly.
My brother was pinned in with two broken legs, and I pulled my niece out. Luckily, we were close to a house, and I said, get some blankets so my niece will not get in shock.
Yeah.
But anyway, we survived that, and I couldn't believe I was alive.
So everyone survived.
But I called on my maker, Lord save me, because you're the only one. I was prepared to die. I knew I was going to die.
Wow. This sounds even scarier for you personally than everything you endured in the war.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, someone must have been looking out for you.
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine being in that situation either. Is there anything else about that situation that you wanted to share?
No.
Fair enough. I think that says it all.
Yeah.
And I imagine that does give you kind of a new lease on life when you survive something like that.
That's right.
We've got a couple minutes left here, Gus, and I'm curious. I know that you had the privilege of going to a couple reunions with your 6th Armored Division, your fellow veterans. What did you get out of that? How special was that for you to see some of these guys and see what had been
going
on in
their lives?
It was great.
That was a great feeling. It was a great feeling, especially the one in St. Louis, Missouri.
Mm-hmm. See, this was about 20 years after the war.
Yeah, it was the 20th reunion, 1967.
Uh-huh.
I had gone out to Palm Springs to get my son's car because he was in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And but luckily, he was in Germany. So I drove to St. Louis, and my wife flew down from Flint, Michigan. We met there, and we attended the convention. And I saw a lot of my friends. I'm just sorry I didn't bring that big scroll of a picture.
A picture to show me from that reunion.
Yeah, right.
One of these days, I'll get a look at it.
Yeah, I hope I can find it.
Did it occur to you at that point when you saw all these guys again, did it maybe mean more to you than what you guys had done? Did it reinforce for you why what you did in World War II was important?
I really never give it a thought.
Yeah?
I never give it a thought.
You're always looking forward, not backwards, aren't you?
That's right.
I get that sense about you.
Yeah.
Well, Gus, in closing, is there anything else that you'd like to share about your experiences in World War II or the men you served with, or why it's important for us to remember World War II all these years later?
Well, I know one thing. We were a great generation, and today we're enjoying the fruits of that generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I was part of it.
Well, me too, and I'm glad you came in to share some of those stories. Gus, thank you for serving our country, and keep on trucking, huh?
Okay.
You look pretty good for 88. Gus Caceres has been our guest today. Again, if you'd like to see some pictures of Gus now or back then in World War II when he was with the 6th Armored Division, go on over to our website, kmjnow.com, or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. Also online, you can find past editions of Hometown Heroes all the way back through 150 episodes. We'll be back next week with another World War II veteran here on the radio. Thanks for listening today to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.